Wow, what an honor. My name's Wally, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm the DCM for 13A. I want to welcome you to the NFL playoffs. I just looked, and the Chiefs won 27-20, and the Giants and Eagles are starting in 5 minutes. I knew y'all had a choice. You know, that's really cool. Football or Wally, and here we are. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. I want to start with a couple of funny stories. I told this one at the cluster forum, but it was so great I got to do it again. A Georgia fan and a Tennessee fan were on death row, coming down to their final hours, and they went to the Tennessee fan. They said, "Do you have any final wishes?" The Tennessee fan said, "Yeah, I want to hear Rocky Top one more time." They said, "Okay, we'll do that." They went to the Georgia fan and said, "Do you have any final wishes?" He said, "Yeah, I want to die first." Two drunks were hired to clean up around a spaceship down at NASA, or around a rocket, and they were down there cleaning up around the bottom of it. Something dripped off the side of the rocket and landed on this one guy's nose, and he stuck his tongue out and he caught it. He thought, "Gin. They got gin up there in that rocket." So they went and got some bottles and they put them down there. That afternoon, they both had a bottle full of gin. Later that night, the guy got a phone call, and it was the other guy, and he said, "Man, did you finish your bottle of gin?" He said, "Well, not quite. Why?" He said, "Well, I'm warning you, don't fart. I'm calling you from St. Louis." Okay. I want to first off thank Tracy. Tracy called me 2 days ago and asked me if I'd be a speaker. And the first thing she said is, "You don't have to say yes." I said, "Yes, I do." You can never say no to Tracy, but thank you so much for thinking of me. I'm so honored to do this. This is just such an absolute blessing. I love this place, and I love all of you. Before I get into my story, I too want to say I am so glad to be back in person. I want to say thank you to Georgia AA 2022. That was such an amazing, great year that we were all back in person again. All the committees that did everything. I went to my first cluster forum, and it was here. And it was absolutely amazing. And Amy chaired that meeting, and she was up here and just did an absolutely amazing job, and I just fell in love. I mean, I thought she was so amazing. One time during the meeting, I walked by her, and I said, "Practice principles, practice principles, practice principles." Anyway, she was amazing. That was great. And then also the Soberfest. Did anybody go to Soberfest over in Byron? Was that good? Was that good? That was amazing. Big Mike in that dress and all that. It was really cool. My name is Wally, and I'm an alcoholic. I was born May 6th, 1952. Long, long, long time ago. If you do the math, you'll figure out that I'm now over 70 years old. My sober date is December 8th, 2012. So I just last month picked up 10 years. But I also was figuring I was drinking for 56 years. Yeah, I had a long career. We'll get into that. I was born in Evansville, Indiana, to a middle-class family, wonderful, beautiful middle-class family. My mother and dad had both been married before. Both of them had two kids. They got married and had three of us, and I had an absolutely amazing life with them. When I was real young, about 2 years old, we moved to Memphis, Tennessee, which is where I was raised, in Memphis. My father was a machinist at International Harvester, and my mother was a homemaker. She stayed home. She never worked. She never drove, never got a driver's license. It was just an incredibly beautiful way of life. She was so kind and loving and giving and caring. My dad drank a little bit, but not a lot, so I don't really know where this came from. But I remember, and I got kidded my whole life about this, but probably when I was about 5 or 6 years old, my dad was decorating the Christmas tree, and he drank Falstaff beer. Anybody remember Falstaff? He drank Falstaff beer, and he left his Falstaff beer there, and he was working on the tree, and I went over and grabbed that Falstaff beer, and I drank the whole thing. And that was my first real experience. Yeah, it was good. And so later that night, I went over and I crawled up on my dad's lap, and I said, "Daddy, I'm busy." And I got kidded about that my whole life. I was busy. And I tried my best to be busy for the next 50 years. Because I like being busy. just other incidents that I remember. I was in junior high school, and I remember after hours at late at night, and I went out in the yard behind the school, and there were some older guys there, and they were selling Miller High Life in the big bottles, you know. So I bought some of them, and that was another big experience I had. But then later I realized the bottles I bought had been opened. So there's no telling what in the world I was drinking. There's just, who knows. But it was just crazy stuff like that. And I remembered later, too, when I got one of my first cars, and my friends and I, we were out partying and drinking, and then on the way home, there was a car wash that was up the street from where I lived. And I'd have to stop at the car wash to wash the vomit off the car before I got home. It, you know, just hanging heads out the window and just all that stuff over and over and over and just did it over. And it was so crazy. I went to Memphis State University, which has now changed their name, but I went to Memphis State and I graduated from Memphis State back in 1974. And I was drinking a lot then. But I got my first job right after I graduated. I got a degree in electronics and I graduated and I went to work at Baptist Memorial Hospital. A lot of you may remember Baptist Memorial Hospital in Memphis. That's where they took Elvis Presley. So I was there many times when they brought Elvis in. And there was one time when I got a call from security and they wanted me to come up and work on his TV set. They didn't want to place just a standard service call. You know, they didn't want to go through the process. So the head of security knew me and he called me and asked me to come up there. So I went to Elvis's room and went in. He was asleep, so I didn't get to really talk to him, but he was asleep, and I worked on his TV, and I fixed his TV. It was so cool. And then and then it was a few years later, August 1977. You remember what happened? I remember hearing the call for security to the emergency room, and I looked out the window, and I saw the ambulance come in, and I saw all the security people. I saw police everywhere, and I thought, that's somebody important. So this guy I was working with, I said, let's go down there. So we went down to the emergency room, and we saw him bring this guy in. Didn't know who it was. And girl pushing the EKG cart came out, and I followed her back to the elevator. I said, who was that? She said, it was Elvis. I said, how is he? She said, he's dead. And she had just run the EKG on him. So, you know, I'm one of the first few people in the world to know that Elvis Presley was dead. That's my real claim to fame. Got married about the same time to my very first wife, and yeah, there's multiple, and yeah, that I was in the corporate world at that time. Let's see, from the Baptist Hospital, I went to work. I was there for 4 years, and I got really tired of seeing sick people and seeing people die and all that stuff. So General Electric Medical hired me as a CAT scan engineer. I was a CAT scan tech back when CAT scans first came out, and I was flying all over the place taking care of CAT scan machines, which was really cool. But they were being run by Data General Computers, and Data General found out about me, and they came and hired me. And so then I went to work for Data General. And Data General was a wonderful company. They moved me to Nashville, Tennessee. And then they moved me to Boston, Massachusetts. And then they moved me to Northern California. And then I ended up quitting that company, and I went back to Memphis, and I got hired by General Electric again. This was a different division of GE. I went back to work for GE. And they moved me to Chicago. And I was in Chicago for 2 years, and then they moved me to Atlanta for the first time. And then that division got bought out and by IBM. So I went to work for IBM, and IBM moved me to Dallas, Texas. So I went Nashville, Boston, California, Memphis, Chicago, Atlanta, Dallas, and then back to Atlanta. And when I moved back to Atlanta is when I got my first divorce. I moved the family all over the entire country and everything. And it was a really great experience for my son. I've got one son who's now 40 years old. He's also in the program. And he and I are so tremendously close. It's amazing. He tells me stuff there's no way I would have ever told my dad. I thought, wow. Anyway, we're really, really close. I go to visit. He's in Memphis. I go up to visit him in Memphis, and we go to meetings together. And it's just absolutely beautiful. That's when I got my first divorce. After I got laid off from IBM in 2000, and it's like, well, what do you want to do? And my whole life, I always wanted to, I wanted to do remodeling because this old house came on TV. Anybody remember Bob Vila? And I loved that show. I was so into it. And as I moved all around the country, I worked on my own house. I did all that stuff, and I couldn't get enough of it. So I thought, well, what do you really want to do? And I thought, well, that's what I want to do. So I started my own company, which was wonderful. That was really terrific. But it gave me the freedom to do what I wanted to do, you know. And during those corporate years, I remember that it was really kind of a mixed blessing because I had to go to work and I couldn't drink. So I would come home at night and I would drink at night every day, but still it throttled me back. And I remember traveling around the country while I was in the corporate world, and I would go to, you know, various hotels and stuff, and I had requirements. If I went to a hotel, they had to have a bar. If I went to dinner anywhere, they had to have a bar. That was, you know, I would not go to McDonald's or Crystal's or anything that didn't have a bar because I was going to go and I was going to drink. And I did that a lot, but it really kind of helped throttle things back to the point to where it didn't get really too serious, but I was still drinking every day until I started my own business, and that gave me the freedom to, you know, I can go anytime I want to. And then in 2008, the economy kind of crashed, and it really hurt our industry really, really bad. And so things kind of fell apart for me, and I got really super depressed, and I was drinking and depressed, and I was drinking for a depression, which is really stupid. And so my now second wife said she wanted me to go to the doctor for depression. So I was going to the psychologist, and I went week after week after week after week for a long time about depression. And then finally one day he said to me, "I think you've got a drinking problem." And I said, "No, I don't." You know, and he said, "Is there any chance your wife is going to leave you?" I said, "No." He said, "Okay, next week I want her to come here." So the next week we went back together and we went in together, and he said to me, "You know, you just shut up." And he said to her, "Is there any chance you're going to leave him?" She said, "Yeah, I've already made arrangements." But I was drinking a lot every day. I was a social drinker. I would go to the bar. I would go in with the intent of drinking one drink and having lunch. And that never worked. And I would drink several, and then, you know, guys would come in, we'd share rounds, and then I'd drink, and then I didn't want to be embarrassed, so I'd go to another bar, and I'd do that, and I'd drink there, and then I'd go to another bar, and I'd just slowly work my way back home. And I'd get home, and I'd just pass out. I was done. I remember, I'm not going to do this tomorrow. And every day I did. And then that doctor that I was going to, he one day said, "You can continue to pay me all this money if you want to, but the folks down at 8111 can do more for you for a dollar a day than I ever could. Thank you, PICPC." He got the message. So after hearing that, I thought, well, maybe. And that was that first little bit of willingness that cracked for me, and that little bit of willingness that opened the door. So I finally said, okay, I'm going to go to a meeting. First meeting I went to was a men's meeting in Roswell. And I went in there and I thought my life was over. I thought, my God, I'm a failure. Oh, my God, this is horrible. How did I stoop this low? And I went into the meeting and I met the most kind, wonderful, loving people I've ever met in my entire life. It just blew me away. They were so welcoming. And I remember two guys, microphone go off. What? Changing tape. Go ahead. Okay, thank you. You got me? You good, Ken? So two guys grabbed me and they said, "You got to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, "You're crazy. I can't do that. I got a life, you know." And I said, I didn't have a life. All right. Yeah. And I did a lot more than 90 meetings in 90 days. I probably did 120, 130 meetings in 90 days because I found out that 8111 was the only place on the planet that I didn't want to drink. I remember going into the bar right before I stopped, and I'd go in and I'd do this, you know. And I'd get my arm down on the bar, and the bartender would get that drink in my hand, and I'd get that first drink, and those shakes would stop. And I did that every day for years and years and years, it just couldn't stop. When I came in, I had absolutely no choice. My gift of choice was gone. But I came into this program. And And I think one of the greatest gifts, out of the many, many gifts I've been given, is the gift of choice. I now choose to not drink, and I choose not to drink every single day. And it's an absolute wonderful blessing. When I first came in, there was a guy that was chairing, a young guy was chairing that first meeting, and I thought, well, this is Providence. He's supposed to be my sponsor. So I went to him and asked him to be my sponsor, but he was a lot younger than me. And during our first meeting, he told me I had character defects, so I fired him. I thought, this young kid doesn't know me. There's no way. And just total denial. So I got a second sponsor, and he was older, just a little older than me, and he was such a kind, gentle, wonderful, wonderful man. He slowly took me through the steps, and he did a superb job, but it took a long time. I got to four, and I was so scared to death. Four just frightened the absolute hell out of me. And I thought, there's no way I can do five. I can't. There's just no way I can do five. There's no way I can tell this to another human being. And I went to a doctor when I was about 8 months in for sinusitis, a medical doctor. I went into the office, and I filled out the forms. And on the forms, it says, do you drink? And I said, no. And it said, how much? And for the first time in my life, I told the truth. I said, zero. Because I always lied on those things, always. So the doctor came in with that form into the room, and he looked at it, and he said, you don't drink? I said, nope. He said, are you friends with Bill W.? I said, as a matter of fact, I am. So he said, I'll be right back. He left and went down to his office, and he got the big book. He came back with the big book. He opened it up to how it works. Started reading how it works, and we had an amazing meeting in there. It was so good. It was so good. And then he went and did his, did the whole thing, did the exam and everything. And then he wrote two prescriptions for me, one for antibiotics for my sinusitis. And then on a doctor's pad, I actually have a written prescription that says, read step 7. A medical prescription from a medical doctor. Best medicine I've ever had by far in my entire life. It's absolutely amazing. I've heard it in the program before, in meetings before, that, if a cancer patient went to a doctor and the doctor said, you'll be fine if you just go to a meeting every day, would you go? Hell yeah. He told me to go to a meeting every day. That's my prescription. I've been taking that prescription ever since. And that prescription's made everything better. I was taking trazodone. I was taking Wellbutrin. When I got to step 7 and I swallowed that prescription, that stuff just went away. And it just progressively got better and better and better and better. I was in a meeting the other day, and the guy said, I can't sleep, and I'm taking trazodone. He said, what do you take to sleep? And I said, step 7. It's really good medicine. I mean, if I was a medical doctor and could write a prescription, I'd write a prescription for every single one of you. Because that step especially, just totally, dear God, please remove all these defects of character. And I felt it. I felt that tremendous relief. And just so amazing. So much of the lessons that I've learned. I remember when I first came in, the second meeting I think I went to, they gave me the promises to read. And, I didn't know what I was doing. I read this sheet of paper, and I read those promises, and I started crying. And I thought, really? Really? I can have this? No kidding? Really? And those promises is one of the key things that got me saying, I want to come back. I want what these people got. So I wanted those promises. So I just kept coming back and kept coming back and kept coming back and kept coming back. And slowly, at one point, you turn around and you look back, and it's like, damn, this stuff does work. It's true. And I have met the most incredibly kind, loving people I've ever met in my entire life in this program. When I was going down to the Sober Fest, right before I left, I went to a meeting up in Atlanta, and I told them in my meeting, I said, I'm getting ready to go down to Byron, Georgia, I'm going to go down and spend the weekend with 400 of my best friends that I've never met. Yeah. It was cool, man. It was so good. I loved that. So I'm going to do a lot of that this year. I've already signed up for all of them this year, and we're going. It's just absolutely tremendous. some of the things in the program that I'm just really fascinate me. And as I said, when I came in, I was so loaded with fear. Fear would just consumed me. I was afraid of everything. Blue lights, especially. But, you know, I had a fear of the mailbox, and I remember I couldn't sleep at night. I would lay in bed at night, and I would stare at the ceiling, and I would just make up stuff to worry about. Just make it up, just crazy stuff, you know. And I'd wake up late, you know, I'd look at the ceiling, I'd wake up the next morning, and I'd say, why was I worried about that, you know? It reminds me of a story about a guy that's driving down a country road, and he has a flat tire. And he checks, and he doesn't have a jack. And he thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do? So he looks up on the hill, and there's a light on a cabin up on the hill. And he thought, well, good. So I'm going to go up on that cabin, and I'm going to knock on the door, and a real nice people are going to come to the door, and I'm going to say, well, excuse me, but I had a flat down here, and I need some help. And they're going to say, absolutely, let me get the jack for you. We'll go down there, and we'll take care of it, and then we'll go down and change the tire, and then they'll invite me back to dinner, and we're going to have an absolute wonderful, wonderful night. So he's working his way up there to the door, and as he's getting up there close, the light goes out. And he said, oh, no. Now they're going to be in bed. Now they're going to be angry. And I'm going to get up there and I'm going to knock on that door. And they're going to come to the door and say, what the hell do you want? And I'm going to tell them, this is going to be horrible. But he said, I'm going to do it anyway. So he walked up there and he knocked on the door. And they opened the door and said, yes, how can we help you? He said, go to hell. I didn't want to borrow your damn jack anyway. We get in our heads. That is so true. We make up stuff that never, never, never happens. You know? And faith, fear and faith, step three. And I have so learned that faith drives out fear. Fear and faith cannot exist together. Fear only has as much power as you give it. Faith works the same way. So now I really try hard just to practice faith. And the more I believe, the more I believe. There was some time ago I had this situation at work where, you know, it was a financial thing, and I got in my head, and I thought, this is fatal. This is horrible. This is bad. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to make it through this. And all that, and I did. I came through it. It was fine. It was nothing. It was absolutely nothing. And I realized at that point, the whole problem was I didn't have the faith to believe that if I turn it over, let go, let God, let the program work, it's going to work out. I mean, I thought I had believed it up to that point, but that was the real test that I needed to really prove it to me. That if you just turn it over and let faith work, it works. I created all that anxiety and all that hell, all that stuff. It was right here. I created it, and I didn't have to. So I now practice faith, and I just believe in my heart of hearts that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be. Everything in this world is perfect. Nothing happens in God's world, you know, I mean, Page 417, man, I just read acceptance all the time. And acceptance and just let go and let God and just believe it's going to be okay because it is. I tell my sponsees it's going to work out or it's going to work out. It's that simple. It's either it's going to be okay or it's going to be okay. You may not be the answer you want, but it's going to be right. And generally it turns out much better than what I wanted. And the more I practice that, the more I learn that it's absolutely true. Just absolutely amazing. The other thing that I've learned, too, is that we all have these ups and downs. Life on life's terms. We still, you know, in sobriety, we have all this bad stuff that happens to us. It happens a lot. You know, I'm going through another divorce right now, but that's fine. It's fine. It's I am perfectly good with it. I look at it like an opportunity, you know, because when I get out the other, when I get out the other side of this, it's going to be incredibly beautiful, you know, and I'm just going to move on. This time, I'm not going to make the same mistake, and you know. But I learned from those things. But those life on life's turns and those bumps that we hit in the road, I've realized that what they are there for is to make us better. They make us stronger. You know, I like for my program to be tested. I like to hit those bumps in the road. Because if my program... program's not tested, I don't know if it's working. So I say now, bring it on. Bring it on. Just whatever. There is nothing that can happen to me that's going to interrupt my sobriety. Well, maybe a few things. But, I mean, for the most part, I really try to practice that. Nothing that can happen is going to interrupt my sobriety. I'm going to practice the principles. I'm going to learn what I've learned in these rooms. And I'm going to apply those principles. And you come through it. You just accept it and let it go. And the beauty of that is it's just like exercising anything else. The more you exercise it, the stronger it gets. So every one of those bumps just makes my program that much stronger. And the next time, it's even better. It's just unbelievably how good this is. Another thing, when I was going through the steps and I got up to step 11, and you know, we were talking about meditation and all that stuff, and I thought, I can do this without that, you know. I can just skip that one. I don't need that one. And so I moved into step 12 and I started doing service work and I started to help people, and I was a lot better. I mean, it was really amazing good. I'm not saying that, but at some point during the process, I realized that step 11, if there is a graduation ceremony for this program, it is step 11. The end of step 11 says, and the power to carry that out. That's where we are granted the power to carry the message. That's where we get out of our head. And what are we trying to do in step 11? We are trying to align our will with God's will. Get out of our self-will. And the beauty is that if you can ever get to the point to where you can align your will and God's will, your will becomes God's will. That to me is just amazing. If you get to that point, that's when you get pure serenity. There is no more conflict. All the promises come true, including 10. We cease fighting anything or anyone, including alcohol. All you have to do is practice those principles and try to align your will with God's will. And that's when we'll really get the serenity. So now I'm practicing 11 like crazy. I just love 11 now. I think 11 is probably the most powerful step now for me. One time I was avoiding it. But 11's really, they're all beautiful. I mean, they all have incredible strength. It is so good. And I want to read something out of step 11 that I'm sure you all have heard a million times. But it is, let me see if I can find it here. Well, here we go. This to me is the perfect example of your will versus God's will. The St. Francis Prayer. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, my will, I may bring love, God's will. That where there is wrong, my will, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, God's will. That where there is discord, my will, I may bring harmony, God's will. That where there is error, I may bring truth. That where there is doubt, I may bring faith. That where there is despair, I may bring hope. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted. To understand than to be understood. To love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. What an amazing, amazing prayer. And that's really step 11. because that is where we're trying to get out of our will, get into God's will, get into alignment. You get into that alignment, you get into serenity, you get into peace, and everything comes together. It's so amazing, beautiful. I can't imagine I'm doing this now, but over the last couple of years, I've been doing something that I never thought I would be able to do, and I want to ask Marcus to put that. Can you bring that slide up? Yeah. I'm now a sober Santa Claus. And, you know, I can't even remotely imagine when I was drinking being Santa Claus and having kids crawl up in my lap. I hated kids and I didn't want anything to do with them. They, you know, and they didn't want anything to do with me, you know. I was just a sloppy drunk and everything. But now it is so much fun. I was in the 8111 parking lot and I was getting out of the truck, and this lady came over to me and said, he's going crazy. Can he come see you? He jumped out and he ran over to me, and you can see he jumped up on me and gave me that hug. And it was so warm and welcoming, just absolutely amazing. And he said to me, did you come to my house last night? This was actually on Christmas Day. Did you come to my house last night? I said, yes, I did. And I said, I drank half the milk. And he just went, I mean, his eyes were so big, and the love and all that. And it was just, it was amazing. But that picture is one of my absolute favorites. But that's only possible because of this program. It's only possible because of this program. So I don't know how I'm doing on time, but I, maybe a little early, but I always like to close meetings with this, if I can find it. This is one of my favorite, absolute favorite readings I've ever heard in the program. It's called Symptoms of Inner Peace. We hear about this inner peace that we get in the program. Well, here it is. A tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than on fears based on past experiences. An unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment. A loss of interest in judging other people. A loss of interest in conflict. A loss of the ability to worry. Frequent, overwhelming episodes of appreciation. Contented feelings of connectedness with others, nature, self, and God. Frequent attacks of smiling. I never thought I'd smile again. This is sin. An increasing tendency to let things happen rather than make them happen. An increased susceptibility to the love extended by others, as well as the uncontrollable urge to extend it. I love all of you more than you can possibly imagine. I try to extend love to everything and everybody. I went to Waffle House the other day and she poured my coffee. I was telling Claire this the other day. She poured my coffee and I said, I love you. She looked at me like I was absolutely crazy. But I try to extend the love in everything that I do, and I really, truly do love all of you, and thank you for being here, and thank you for helping me stay sober. Thank you so much. Thank you.